This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Seneca Network from the China Project. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I'm your host, Jared Turner, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, longtime resident of China, and I'm telling you, all generalizations are false. My co-host is John Pazin, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinospice.com, and he identifies as sarcastic, and his pronouns are har, har. Do you keep learning new vocab words but have trouble using it? John and I are going to talk about the vocabulary dilemma many learners find themselves in and the balance between knowledge and proficiency. Guest interviews with Amy Sellico, international political and economic consultant, a former United States senior trade representative, and a lifelong Chinese learner. Let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah here in the United States.
Hey everybody, my name is John Pazdin. I am in Shanghai, China. How's it going?
Well, hey John, Xin Yin Hao. Hey,
happy Chinese.
It's a brand new year.
It is a year of the rabbit.
That's right. What's special about Year of the Rabbit? Remind me.
There's a rabbit.
Fantastic. All right. It's going to be an awesome year. I'm sure of it, right?
I think it's going to be much better than last year. I am quite sure of it.
Well, John, you know, recently I was talking to someone and they were just expressing that opinion about how, hey, you know, I need to improve my Chinese and I just need to memorize more words, vocabularies. That's where it's at.
Right, because vocabulary is the building blocks of language. So you just learn it all and then you can just build anything, right?
Exactly. You just need to get that dictionary and just start like going through it line by line and memorize everything, right?
Yeah, maybe not exactly like that. So that's what we're talking about today. You could call it the vocabulary dilemma. So obviously you need to memorize vocabulary. You need to know words in order to speak and in order to understand and to read. But if you spend all of your time just memorizing vocabulary, then you're not actually building fluency.
That's right, because fluency is a whole heck of a lot more than just memorizing words, right?
Right, so memorization, it's kind of, you know, knowledge. Whereas fluency is more like proficiency, being able to use the language quickly, flexibly, instinctively even.
Definitely, definitely. So I think this would be a great opportunity here to unpack this here for all of our listeners and many who are, I mean, it's totally fine pursuing more vocabulary, but we're going to unpack this and talk about some of the nuance of this and I think a little bit how to make sure you're balancing all things considered.
Right. So most learners don't learn exactly like a kid, you know, like a baby doesn't actually try to memorize vocabulary. Most of us do, you know, consciously memorize some vocabulary as part of our Chinese studies. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's normal. But let's think a little bit about, like, what are we doing when we're memorizing vocabulary? So, like, hopefully we're focusing on making sure we know the correct pinyin and the correct tones for a word, right?
Definitely. And that's definitely an important part. It's really easy to get caught up in that whole of like, hey, just memorizing new words because, you know, it's really easy to forget what you just learned. It's easy to forget, you know, the pinyin, how the pronunciation, the tone. And so I think even in Chinese, perhaps there can be a little bit even stronger of a focus on this of just say trying to acquire that new vocabulary and I didn't even mention characters, you know, those are easy to forget. So there's a lot of things that are easier. Chinese has more elements that makes it easier to forget all the different words and characters and everything that you're learning. And so sometimes it puts a little bit stronger focus in the minds of learners on like, oh, we just need to memorize this and learn this vocabulary.
Yeah, and let's not forget, as a beginner, you do not just master the tones or all the syllables of pinyin like right in the beginning. So as you're learning new words, you're kind of learning each syllable of pinyin. You know, you're trying to remember how to spell it. You're trying to learn the tones. And does the fourth tone go down or up? You know, so of course, that's not easy. And yeah, we understand that. So it's quite a burden on your memory just memorizing those simple words in the very beginning. All right, but obviously, you just can't keep doing that forever. You are going to get familiar with pinyin. You are going to start getting better at the tones. And if what you're doing when you're memorizing is just like saying the English when you see the Chinese or saying the Chinese when you see the English, then you are, you know, building vocabulary in a sense. You're memorizing this kind of knowledge, but is that something that you can actually use in the way that you want to be able to use it?
Yeah, that's definitely true, John. And I think something that, you know, I've noticed in working in my own experience, but also working with other learners, is that if you're focusing mainly on that memorization and you're lacking a lot of this practice and proficiency that we're going to be talking about here in just a minute, but you do begin to really kind of learn and understand those words using your native language. So in our case, English, right? And so, okay, yeah, I memorize this word, I memorize the meaning, but is that meaning, do I really comprehend and understand it in the language of Chinese? Or am I really, like, when I see that word, yeah, I can recall the pinyin and the definition, but it's mainly like I'm thinking about it in English. And that's a problem. That's something that, you know, comes over time, but we definitely have to work on practice and using the language to get past some of those things.
Yeah, and that's why linguists love to talk about context, right? The context of a word, when to use it, when you encounter it. And so to unpack this further, let's take a look at two specific examples. So the example of comprehending vocabulary when you're reading and the example of using vocabulary in your speaking. Okay, so first let's take a look at the reading. So, you know, when you look at a reading, whether it's just a sentence or a short passage, you need to recognize the characters. You need to figure out the word boundaries, like these two characters are one word, like, right? That's the first step. And then you need to remember these two characters together. What are they? You know, you're probably going to remember the pinyin, the pronunciation, the tones, and the meaning. And then you need to understand the word in its context. You need to take a look at the grammar and see what that word is doing. Why is that other word over there, right? And so this kind of encountering vocabulary and understanding it in context, this is a form of proficiency.
Yes, definitely, John. And I also want to add one other thing to this when you're learning to read in Chinese, and that's also parsing the language. And I know you're probably implying that with just, you know, being able to recognize, oh, this is a character and, you know, the standalone character, and this is a word. But, you know, that's an important thing. And I think also when you're reading in Chinese, you know, there's a little bit more going on than if you're learning to read Spanish or Swahili or whatever, because, you know, there's usually spaces between the words. And once again, you come across a word you don't know, usually you can sound that out. But obviously, you know, and we typically don't have tones, and there are other tonal languages. But so you have the just simply recognizing characters, also parsing those characters, and then also adding that tonal aspect. So those are usually three things which are just a little bit more of a burden when it comes to reading in Chinese.
And I think it goes without saying that when you're reviewing your vocabulary, whether it's with flashcards or whatever, you know, you don't have to do that parsing. You don't have to figure out, you know, are these two characters this word, or are they like actually each character is part of another word, or actually it's two words that just happen to be that same character. You know, you don't have to do any of that when you're reviewing your flashcards or whatever, because they're nicely packaged as individual words. So I think Jared is right to emphasize that parsing aspect of reading, because that's something that's kind of unique to Chinese. Not totally unique. Some other languages have it too. But for a lot of learners of Chinese, they've never had to do that before. And so just recognizing the vocabulary words in a sentence can be a challenge.
So this will come down to that aspect. Hey, you're given a text, and let's even say you know all the characters, even all the words in that text. But, like, can you really read it with any speed and fluency? Because, you know, we talk about being fluent in language. Well, can you fluently read? And if that's a struggle for you, then this may be one of those areas that, we really need to work on. Now you're saying, hey, the difference between knowledge and proficiency and something, and memorizing and practice. You know this, but can you use it well, and can you comprehend it well?
And I think a lot of us, and I think I've done this too, if we're honest with ourselves, we have to admit that in the back of our mind, we're kind of thinking, well, if I memorize all this vocabulary, then I can just read it. And maybe we know that's not true, but there's just like part of our mind that just wants to believe that because it's just simpler.
You know, what's interesting is the studies that I've seen regarding to reading speed. And this is one of the strongest predictors of fluency in any language. So it's like, okay, you know it, but are you able to read it quickly? And it's kind of interesting because the studies really show, and if you can think about your own personal experience, is if you're reading really slowly I mean, it could be for whatever reason, you're reading slowly in your own native language. Your actual level of comprehension frequently decreases. And it's because, you know, we only retain things in our memory for, a certain period of time. And if you're sometimes, I've experienced this in Chinese, I know other people have, is by the time you get to the end of the paragraph, you're not even sure what you read. Maybe your comprehension was low, but if you know all the stuff and you're reading really slow, that can also happen. And so there needs to happen a sufficient reading speed for comprehension. And so it's a bit of that, you know, counterintuitive that, oh, the faster I read, the better I'm going to comprehend. Well, it's a little bit backwards. This is that the better you are at comprehending things, the quicker you're also going to be able to read. So, you know, they go a little bit hand in hand, but reading speed is a strong predictor of fluency. There you go, the F word, in a language.
Okay, so to wrap up, you need vocabulary, obviously, but when it comes to reading, that's a skill you need to build. You need to practice it. And so you know the words, quote unquote, know from your flashcard reviews or whatever, but you got to be seeing them in context and reading them to really own them.
And that's absolutely right. And, you know, I'll point out one other study, John, is that there are studies that show, hey, you can learn words faster with flashcards. And to a degree, that is true. It shows like, hey, your ability to recall that word is going to be faster if you've just been flashcarding yourself to death. But what's really interesting is that they've shown that, oh, but reading in context, you're actually able to comprehend that word and not just be able to know it, but actually be able to use it. Because it's kind of like, all right, maybe you know something, but can you actually use it in a sentence? If it's used in a different way, you know, and when you're listening or receiving it some other way, can you understand comprehend what was being said? So, you know, there's a lot more going on than just memorizing a word.
Yeah, we are talking about using language for communication. And I think I don't need to quote a study to make the point that it's not very easy to communicate with a native speaker with flashcards, right? You actually got to speak, or maybe you got to type and read. But the flashcards themselves, yeah, they're a means to an end, but they're not the end. Okay, so communication. Let's move on to the other part, which is speaking. So obviously you need vocabulary when you're speaking. You want to have good pronunciation as well. You're going to need to determine the proper context for using the word in a certain situation, a certain meaning. And this obviously can be very difficult. You know you've learned this word, but when it comes time to use it, can you recall it? And just because you can get it right when you do your flashcards doesn't mean you can always use it at the right moment, in the right way, with the right grammar in a sentence. And unfortunately, that's something that you just kind of have to trudge through. You have to practice it, and you're going to make mistakes. But if you keep practicing, you're going to get better at it because it is a skill. It's not a form of knowledge.
John, I can't agree with you more on this, and this brings to mind, a paper I had read early on when I was starting learning all about extensive reading, comprehensible input, all these things. It's by Rob Waring, and he brings up these concept of collocations. And I think, as John, we've talked about, the better word for that, in layman's terms, is word pairs, word partners, right? And he brings up the concept of an idea. So, all right, you may learn that word idea. But is it used in so many different contexts, and has all these different things it can be paired with? So like he brings up here, I got a list here. It's like abandon an idea, absorb an idea, accept an idea, adjust to an idea, advocate for an idea, amplify an idea, advance idea, and a lot. And I haven't even gotten past the A's there, right? And we have so many other adjectives and things that, you know, partner with and go with that word idea. But that is not unique to English. That is a feature of pretty much of all languages, that there are certain words that pair properly and well with other words and some words that don't. And how are you going to learn all of those? The only way you can truly encounter all those, and you could sure study lists of them, but there's so much of it that you can't memorize it. There's almost infinite permutations of all these different things. You just have to experience them. And encounter them, if you will, sometimes in the wild, in context, so that you can really begin to understand and get a feel for how these words go together and how the language works properly.
Yeah, you need to get used to these patterns. So part of it is, you know, this verb usually is followed by this object. And some of it is, you know, this word usually comes in this grammar pattern. But the more you hear it, and then the more you try to do it and sometimes fail, and then the helpful native speakers, they correct you. Oh, you mean this? And you're like, oh, yeah, that's what I wanted to say. And I knew that word, and I studied that flashcard 50 times, but I never wanted to say this sentence before, this exact sentence. And it wasn't in my flashcards. It's not until I try to do it, fail, and get help by the native speaker that I know how to do it, and now I'm never going to forget it.
That is something, though, I love about reading, because it's a little bit more of a, I would say, a safer context. You can stop and you can go back. It's a little hard to do that when you're doing with speaking, but, you know, you come across that word and you're like, yeah, I know that word. Oh, I didn't know it could be used this way. Oh, that's a phrase. I can say it like this. And it just, it kind of explores, you know, opens up your mind to all the possibilities. So that's, it's really powerful. But I mean, ultimately this comes down to if experiencing and seeing these words in context, which is invaluable.
And some of those contexts are going to come from you because you want to say something and you're not sure how. And then sometimes it's going to come from the other people. But yeah, that practice is invaluable. You have to go through it. And that is going to build the skill, build the proficiency. And of course, you need some vocabulary, but you got to put in the effort.
And John, you mentioned grammar, but I think, you know, this is also really important to address as well, because grammar is essentially patterns. And, you know, when there's a lot of tendency to like study grammar. But, you know, I refer back to Steve Kaufman, who we've had on this podcast. This is a polyglot. He speaks like 20 languages, amazing guy. But, you know, I asked him how his approach of learning a new language. He's like, I never study grammar. You know, it's like I get there, the familiar with the language, and then I might go back and look at some of the grammar for clarification. And I think this is a great way to approach, you know, learning that grammar, because our brain is very good at recognizing patterns. And the more we see these patterns in context, it just becomes, our brain absorbs it, and that helps us feel what is more natural and right for the language. And that doesn't come very well with like focused study. It becomes better with experience and kind of understanding, absorbing, and naturally acquiring the language. And in this sense, naturally acquiring the grammar structure of the language.
Yeah, there's kind of a pattern that I've noticed with a lot of the people I've worked with. A lot of people, when they first started learning Chinese, they're like, oh, Chinese doesn't have grammar, or Chinese has super easy grammar. And, you know, that's fine. Just learn vocabulary, throw sentences together, go out there and communicate. It's fine. But eventually they'll get to a point, and it's usually around intermediate, when they'll realize that, man, I just keep saying things wrong. And like, I know the words. Why do I keep, what is with this? And then it bugs them. So then they'll go back and they'll study the grammar, because they have like a foundation, and then they can understand it much, and then they can understand it much better because they have the question and they want to get it right. So there comes kind of a time around intermediate where you want to be more focused on grammar because you realize that there's some things you're not getting right. And then after you kind of get over that and you practice it more, then it kind of goes back to patterns. And I feel like at the advanced Chinese level, it's just, you know, picking up words and putting them into the same patterns you already know, and it goes much smoother.
Absolutely. And that's true, because that's at the point where, hey, you're not clear about something, you've encountered it a number of times, now it's time to get clarity on that and some deliberate practice to kind of fix some of those problems.
But I don't think you can go through those phases unless you get out there and you talk a lot, and you just try to use the vocabulary you know, the patterns you know, without focusing on grammar. It's not until later that you realize, oh, I should probably focus on that. All right, so we've said it several times. Flashcards are not bad. They help you build knowledge. You know, you need words to speak. You need words to read. But they're not really helping you build these skills of proficiency in reading and speaking. So how can they be better used to form proficiency? How can we avoid misusing them? And what do you think, Jared?
You know, John, I think flashcards, you know, we do bag on them once in a while here. And they do have their place, though. I think they do have their place. I don't think that they should be like your primary means of acquiring vocabulary, but I think they're excellent if there's just like sometimes those characters that you just like habitually forget, or sometimes it's hard to differentiate between, you know, certain characters at different times. And I'm speaking about that when we're talking about single characters, but there's a lot of more, I would say, advanced or even more beneficial methods of moving beyond just like single character flashcards.
Well, what I'd also like to point out is if you're studying for a test, whether it's in school or whether it's the HSK, and your test quizzes you on the meaning of individual words, well, that's actually where flashcards really shine, because that's testing on knowledge, not so much proficiency. So that's one area, obviously, where flashcards are very appropriate. If you need a test, well, that's the tool for the job. But also, I think there are a lot of our listeners out there who, you know, they want to improve their Chinese, but, you know, they have like 10 minutes on the subway or whatever, and there's no Chinese people. It's not like they're going to be practicing speaking. I mean, they could be reading something, right? But these little, you know, fragmented sections of time can be convenient for reviewing flashcards and, you know, keeping you from forgetting something when you know you're not going to be spending a lot of time reading in the next week or something like that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's relatively an easy thing to do. And if it came down to essentially like studying some flashcards or not studying anything at all, I mean, heck yeah. Okay, all right. You know, go for it. Do it.
But I feel like I've met people who, like, they come to China and they like stay in and study their flashcards so that they can like know more words when they go out tomorrow or something like that. It's like, you're in China, you're only here for a week, just like go out and talk to people, you know? So you definitely don't want to let flashcards take the place of actual communication that you don't get a lot of.
And for anyone who's like a super enthusiastic flashcard advocate, I also would recommend going back and listening to episode number 89 with Jonathan Coveney. It's a vocab apps and learner engagement. Jonathan, you know, he's a fantastic guy. He's actually achieved a high level proficiency in Chinese. And John, you know him, right? You've worked with him.
Yeah, yeah.
But Jonathan, he almost has a bit of a PTSD from his flashcard obsession, if you will. And, you know, he even talks about it in the interview, how he almost he's flashcarded himself to death, if you will. And he had to also find a lot of other avenues to build that proficiency, even though he memorized a lot of these words. You know, he can recall words, you know, meaning and translation sometimes better than his wife, who's Chinese. But yeah, bringing that all together was a bit of more of a challenge for him. And graded readers definitely provided a bit of that bridge for him to bring it all together.
Yeah, and we should also acknowledge that flashcards appeal a lot more to certain personality types, and it's going to be hard for you to, you know, to resist that temptation to just do more flashcards, make more flashcards. And it is definitely a form of learning. Just if you are that type, just remember that you do need other forms of practice. If you're introverted, you can still read. And if you're introverted and don't want to talk to anyone but still want to be able to speak fluent Chinese, well, then you have a problem. You need to find a way to practice that.
You know, John, I think that's a really important aspect you're touching on there because, you know, a lot of times in life we want to have the right and the wrong answer. You know, we'd like to have things be black and white, and flashcards are. Like, you have it right or wrong, right? But when you start getting to speaking and in discussion, and while, yes, there can be wrong ways, you can have it wrong, it's maybe a little harder sometimes to get it right, and you get into more gray areas of like, all right, we're expressing ideas, and, you know, maybe there's no full right way to say a certain thing, and, you know, it can be done a lot of different ways. And so it gets a little bit more ambiguous. It gets a little bit, I guess, a little, you know, softer, if you will. But I think that's one of the beauties of language, that it's flexible in that way, and you have a lot of ways that you can express yourself. And as you really kind of step out some of the comfort zone, as in this instance, you know, getting maybe a little more away from flashcards, it really stretches you, and it can be ways to kind of test your language skills and explore different avenues.
Yeah, totally. And we hope you're up for that challenge because, you know, it's all part of the game. But Jared, I want to leave one final, I guess you could say, warning. Because we're talking about flashcards as if you kind of study your flashcards, then you learn the words, and then you read. Or you study the flashcards, and you learn the words, and then you go talk to people. But actually, you know, it goes both ways. So you might be reading something and pick up new words from what you're reading. Or you might be talking to someone and write down a word that they use that you had never heard before. And I just want to mention that that can be a great way of learning vocabulary, especially if what you're reading is at the right level for you, and especially if the person you're talking to is kind of speaking at a reasonable level to you. But just be careful. Occasionally, people will use a crazy obscure word, or you'll read something that's just actually way too hard. And so if you're not sure, you might want to ask a teacher or a Chinese friend, like, is this a common word? Should I be learning this? Because I think a lot of us have made that mistake of either collecting totally random obscure words from conversation or from readings, and then spending way too much time trying to review those in flashcards, thinking they're going to come up again any minute, and they like never do.
Yeah, so I think it's good to be wise about that, but also just touching and expanding on that a little bit more of like, don't be afraid to, you know, if you are using flashcards, you know, write down phrases. You can write down entire sentences, you know, so it's, you don't have to isolate yourself to just single characters and words.
Yeah, that can be a really effective use of flashcards for sure.
So I think, John, bringing this all together is this concept between, you know, memorization versus practicing and, you know, building proficiency in the language is that, yes, you can study the word elements of the language, you can memorize definitions and acquire more vocabulary, but if you can't use it, then it's not going to be that beneficial to you. And so we need to take that knowledge and develop it into proficiency in the language, and that's really what we're getting at about fluency.
And there is some interplay between the reading and the speaking. Like the more you can read, you'll find that, you know, your speaking mysteriously starts to upgrade a bit in grammatical patterns and words. And if you speak a lot and you actually learn what all the characters and the words are that corresponds to what you're hearing and what you're talking about, it is going to help your reading a bit because you're familiar with these words as you read.
So basically what you need to do is you're going to learn words, but you need to make sure you're using them because we don't use the language in isolation. Even if you're listening to me right now, I'm using all these independent words, but you're not like analyzing and understanding them all independently. You're understanding the idea that I'm expressing. So it's a bit that idea of like, you know, you can learn to, you can study about playing the guitar. You can read a book on it, but you have to actually practice guitar if you want to be able to play it. Graded readers are an excellent way to actually build some of that proficiency. So definitely we always recommend the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, but there's a lot of graded readers out there. You can kind of read at your pace and hopefully at your level and start making sense of how the language all works together. And it gets all these things we're talking about. Definitely you want to have the opportunity of speaking with tutors or whoever who can speak to you at your level. And that helps kind of bring that language all together and you can see how it all works together and create a beautiful piece of music.
All right. And I should mention that my company, All Set Learning, does do online lessons. But now that we're in a post-COVID world, you can also come to mainland China this year, I'm pretty sure. So I hope that is tempting to you guys out there if you're not in China already.
Oh, it's tempting to me, John. All right, now it's time for a word from our sponsor. And today our sponsor is
Mandarin Companion, Chinese graded readers.
And heck, we were just talking about this, John, but today we are going to talk about one of our level 2 graded readers, Jekyll and Hyde.
Right, and we adapted this our own way in a level 2 story that's 450 unique characters to tell this story. We used our own Chinese names, our own Chinese location, our own setting, and it is based on the original story, but it definitely has, you know, our own changes to it, which keep it interesting.
So you can go out and get it today. Jekyll and Hyde is a Mandarin Companion Level 2 graded reader using only 450 basic characters. You can find it on Amazon, Kobo, iBooks, Kindle, or wherever you get your books.
Check it out.
All right, now it's time for rants and raves. John, what do you have for us today? Do you have a rant or do you have a rave?
I have a rave. So, like a lot of people, I've been having a lot of fun with ChatGPT. I got my account in mid-December, I guess, and I've been using it ever since. And, you know, I went on vacation last week to Lijiang here in China. And when I got back, I just like, you know, got right back into ChatGPT because it's can do so many cool things. And that includes doing stuff to learn Chinese. So I want to say right up front that it's not perfect. It's going to make mistakes. ChatGPT is much more impressive when you ask it questions about something you know nothing about because it seems like it knows everything and it seems very confident, but you can't be sure it's correct. And so with Chinese, like my teachers and I, we've been looking at it and evaluating it, and it's pretty good, but it's definitely not perfect. So it can do cool stuff like it can, you know, it can generate pinyin. When you ask it for Chinese, it can easily give you Chinese and simplified or traditional. And it kind of usually gives you pinyin by default. It doesn't parse the pinyin into words the way that you're actually supposed to. And I've tried to get it to do it, but it just won't. I think it just doesn't have that ability. But you can get lots of information about China. If you want to, you can just type directly in Chinese and it'll respond in Chinese. Anything it says, you can ask for the pinyin. You can ask it questions and have it give you answers in both English and Chinese, and you can compare them. You can have it write short paragraphs for your reading practice on certain topics. But here's the thing. When you want it to write like simple Chinese, it really struggles.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's not good at writing simple Chinese. Like I've actually spent a lot of time on this just to see, is there any way to make it better at this? And right now, and I think it's based on the training that the AI has gone through, right now it's just really not good at that. But it still has a lot of uses and it's definitely fun to play with. And by playing with it, you'll be practicing your reading in Chinese. So if you have a ChatGPT account and you haven't messed around with Chinese, I recommend you give it a shot.
So awesome, man. I think, you know, John, we in our Mandarin Companion WeChat group, we've seen some people throwing around like what ChatGPT, like they're asking it like, hey, can you explain this word or, you know, what's this grammar point? And it does a pretty good job there, right?
Yeah, yeah. It also makes some mistakes, especially at the higher levels. But I think at the lower levels, it's pretty good. Like to give an example, I asked it to use a hard vocabulary word. I forgot what word it is, but it's a pretty hard word. Maybe HSK5 or 6, something like that. I asked it to use this word in 10 sentences. And then I showed my teachers and they were like, yeah, only 3 of these are acceptable. The others are just bad.
Yeah.
But if you have it to just tell me a little story or something like that and you don't have all these like constraints, then it does a better job.
Wow, fascinating.
Okay, so Jared, how about you? Rant or rave?
I got a rave. We just had the Chinese New Year here and at our local Asian supermarket, I went there to get some stuff in preparation for the holiday, and guess what I found?
Rabbit.
Okay, well, I mean, like
rabbit meat.
No, not rabbit meat. No. I found yozi. So yozi, it's my favorite Chinese fruit. Well, it's not Chinese fruit exactly, but it's in English, we say call it pomelo. But I just loved it. I'm like, oh, this looks so good. And I found like a really good one. I asked the lady, she's like, oh yeah, they just got shipped in. They're fresh. They're excellent. So it was like, it's like my favorite fruit. And I looked into a pomelo a little bit and it looks like, you know, it's really grown in like, Southeast Asia and stuff. I mean, you have India, Sri Lanka, Philippines, they grow these things. They were brought even to like the Caribbean. I think in somewhere in Central America, they grow these things too. But I love them. If you haven't tried them, you should go get one. They're like a giant grapefruit, like the size of your head. Well, maybe not fully the size of your head, but and the denser, the better. So like, and they're in season right now. I don't know why they're a winter fruit, but they are a winter fruit. Don't get them too early in the season when they first come out because they're just kind of dry. And don't get them too late in the season because, once again, they're kind of dry. But, like, right now, like, end of December, January, February, oh, they're the best. So,
They're a little less sour than a grapefruit and, I guess, less bitter, too, would you say?
Yeah, less sour. They're sweeter. They're still very citrusy, right? But they're a little bit more, sweeter. They're yellowish. If you see them like green, then they've been picked too early. I wouldn't get those. But they're just awesome. I love pomelos. And it's honestly, John, it's like the fruit I really miss about China. It makes me really want to come back this year because I miss you guys.
I just had some today, Jared. It was good and fresh.
Oh, I'm so jealous. Save a bite for me, John. I'm coming to get it.
Might be a little shriveled, but okay.
Hi, I'm Amy Sellico.
I had the privilege of meeting Amy at a China-focused conference in 2022. If I had to describe her, intelligent, insightful, and astute are 3 words that would come to mind.
I am a principal at Albright Stonebridge Group.
Albright Stonebridge is a leading global business strategy firm based in Washington, D.C., founded by former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Principal means she's one of the people leading her company.
So my role here is co-leading our China practice.
Amy has a wealth of insights into China's geopolitical relations. While we do touch on some of that during our chat, I really enjoyed hearing how Amy was able to turn her love and passion for a language into a career. Stay with us. All right, well, you are no stranger to China, but Amy, is the big question. Why did you start learning Chinese?
I really do consider myself a quote-unquote China person because all of my adult life I have spent focused on China, and it all started when I was a junior in high school, taking a class on Chinese Soviet history.
Chinese Soviet history in high school?
In high school.
I'm going to venture, go out on a limb and say there are very, very few high schools offering that type of class.
One of the great things about this independent private high school was that as juniors and seniors, we were able to pick our history and English classes from a whole range of options.
Wow.
And so the assistant headmaster of the school taught a class, and he was a trained historian on China and the Soviet Union. So the first semester was modern Chinese history, and the semester was modern Soviet history. There were eight of us in the class, or juniors and seniors combined. Three of us went to university to study either Russia or China.
Wow.
My two classmates went to study Soviet history, and I went to Mount Holyoke College to study modern Chinese history.
I've got to ask about this because, I mean, this is the 80s. We're still in the middle of the Cold War. So yeah, Russian. I totally get it. But why was China intriguing to you versus the prevailing winds maybe blowing you towards Russia?
Oh, well, it was absolutely because of the Chinese history that I studied. And this professor gets all the credit. It was his syllabus introducing us to great historians about China, some pretty romantic portrayals about modern Chinese history, Red Star Over China by Edgar Snow.
Yes.
By the end of that fall semester in 1985, I think all eight of us wanted to go on our own long march recounting Chinese history. And to this day, there's nothing more interesting in the world than watching China change and grow. But in the 1980s, when I told my father that I wanted to go to college to study Chinese history, I think the blood drained out of his face. And he said, Japan, maybe? But
yeah.
I think my bet was a good one, going to Mount Holyoke to study modern Chinese history. Now, as part of that, of course, I needed to study the language. And so my first day, my freshman year at Mount Holyoke, I started studying Chinese. I was given a Chinese name that I still use to this day. And I had only studied Latin and Greek in high school. And so I'd never studied a spoken language. So from the get-go, I learned that studying Chinese was going to be a lifetime project and not an easy one for me. But to me, studying Chinese was an integral part of what I wanted to do, which was study China.
Wow. Well, maybe you could tell us a little bit about this, because how it was in the old days, having a paper dictionary, right? Looking up by radical and things like that. But what was that experience like? Was this part of a class, or was this something you were just kind of doing independently?
My first 2 years of college, I was in a class. I was also working with my Chinese professor by helping him develop a computer program to help you learn Chinese via computer and not just traditional paper method, which we used at the time. And that, of course, became a great aid for my Chinese.
What was this?
It was nascent back then. My professor was from Taiwan, and we learned traditional characters. And that came in handy when I was going to do my junior year abroad. I was slated to travel to Beijing in July of 1989. And after the crackdown in Tiananmen Square, when the State Department said Americans shouldn't go to China, my parents offered the opinion that this American shouldn't go to China. And so I ended up landing on the fair shores of Taipei and studying in Taiwan for the first semester of my junior year, which was a phenomenal experience. My roommates were from Kaohsiung in the south of Taiwan, and so took me home to their families. And it was my first experience actually interacting in Chinese. And that's when I learned just how terrible my Chinese was, when it was a sink or swim situation.
The stark realization, right? But that sounds like it was a wonderful opportunity. We actually had Chinese speaking roommates. And did they speak English at all, or was Chinese the common language?
They did. They, of course, wanted to practice their English as well, but they weren't English majors at the university. And so, again, it was a terrific tool for me, but I needed to work much, much harder on my Chinese once I was on the ground in Taiwan. The fall of 1989 was a fascinating time for Taiwan history. They were allowing an opposition party for the first time to run in legislative UN elections. The DPP was a new political party. It was just a really exciting time to be there. And I moved to Beijing for the second semester of my junior year and landed in Beijing the day they lifted martial law.
Oh, wow.
For the first time in mainland China, in Beijing as a student, was a wonderful experience as well. A very important thing happened to me while I was in Beijing, and that was a visitor came to our campus in Beijing from the Hopkins Nanjing Center and said, if you continue to work on your Chinese, you can apply to this program where you can study about China in Chinese. And to me, again, my whole ambition always was to become a Chinese historian. So the idea of using Chinese to actually learn about China became my ambition getting into that program. And that helped drive me over the next few years, returning to Mount Holyoke for my senior year of college, going to the University of Massachusetts to take advanced Chinese language classes there, and then going back to China for 2 years, teaching English as I was studying Chinese so that I could get into the Hopkins Nanjing program and continue studying about China using Chinese language.
You know, there's something I'm curious to know a little bit more about, Amy, is what was it about China that really hooked you?
I think it really was the political change happening in the 19th and 20th century in China, seeing how quickly a society and a political system could change from an imperial system to republic to then this nascent communist regime was fascinating. But what continued to really get me was 20th century Chinese history. And that, again, was what I thought was going to be my whole career, was looking at these questions about identity and society and politics. How could that change happen so quickly in one country? When I was at Mount Holyoke, I had an advisor who was a former Foreign Service officer. He really opened up to me this idea of not just looking at U.S. relations with China, U.S. foreign policy, and how China was such an important component of it, but Chinese foreign policy and the activism of Chinese politicians thinking about great power competition, U.S.-Soviet competition, and how it played out. So as a matter of fact, my undergraduate thesis was on the roots of the breakdown in Sino-Soviet relations and really looking at how U.S.-China relations offered an alternative to Mao and Zhou Enlai from this patronage system with the Soviet Union that was never comfortable for Chinese political leaders. And then when I was in Nanjing a few years later, studying with a Chinese historian of modern Chinese intellectual history and then Chinese foreign policy, I looked at the roots of the rapprochement between China and Vietnam after their war with one another. And so again, great power politics, the role of China, its view of itself on the global stage were very much in my mind's eye as I was looking at China. Fascinating changes within China, but also fascinating changes of China in the world. Changes that I continue to look at today. So I think for many of your listeners, Chinese language is an incredibly important tool if you're going to be working on China issues. But to me, what's continued to just keep me so interested in this topic is how quickly China continues to change.
That's pretty neat. I definitely see the alignment of your interests and everything with your career and what you're doing now. But how did you make that break? You know what I mean? There's a lot of people out there who are really passionate or interested in China, and it could be culture or history or everything. But how did you eventually make that segue into saying, hey, this is now an important part of my career, or my career is even based on this?
I remember pretty much to the day when I decided that I wasn't going to continue to pursue Chinese history as the focus of my career. So after I was at the Hopkins Nanjing Center, I applied to do an internship here in Washington, D.C. at the Brookings Institution, a very well-known think tank, mm-hmm. working for a very well-known China scholar. And over that summer, I was doing primary source research, so using my Chinese language skills, helping the scholar write a book that he was working on Chinese foreign policy. It was actually about cross-strait relations and the impact on Chinese foreign policy. And I realized one day when I was sitting in the stacks of the Brookings Library that I was interested in the broad subject matter, but I wasn't really enjoying what I was doing. And it just was a real epiphany for me because I did realize that doing a PhD would mean I was going to do this for about six more years. And so I pivoted, and my Chinese language skills helped me do that. So I was living in Washington, D.C. with Chinese language skills, and that helped me get a job at the International Monetary Fund. I was the bilingual assistant for the executive director for China, so the Chinese People's Bank of China office at the International Monetary Fund was led by somebody who didn't speak English. And that has changed dramatically today.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But back then in the early 1990s, that person was there because of a connection that he had to a political leader. And he needed somebody to help him prepare to give statements in English that he didn't really understand. And that experience really got me interested in international economic policy and China's role in the world beyond just history and foreign policy, but looking at economic issues, which led me to go to graduate school focused on China, but also international economics at Johns Hopkins. I thought, okay, the way that I can actually participate in this, not as an observer, as a historian, is going to be in the U.S. government. And so as soon as I finished up at Johns Hopkins at SAIS, I entered the State Department as an intelligence analyst looking at China and North Korea.
Well, that's interesting to hear because let's rewind back in China in the 1990s and 2000s. If you spoke Chinese, that was good enough, right? But I know that's definitely changed today because it's going to take a lot more than just language skills or some of these roles.
I couldn't agree more. I feel like I was really lucky early in my career because there weren't a lot of people who had Chinese language skills resident in Washington, D.C. Today, it has to be China and. It's assumed that you have to have good Chinese language skills, but then there's what else do you have to offer to many of these roles?
You got hired on as an analyst there for the State Department, right? And your Chinese skills were an important reason you got hired. But how applicable were your Chinese skills in the role?
Well, I was certainly hired in part because of that. But as soon as I got to the State Department, you know, the department was, of course, driven by the foreign policy priorities of the moment. Mm-hmm. And I joined the State Department in the Clinton administration, Secretary Albright, who I ended up working with much more closely here at Albright Stonebridge Group. She was the first Secretary of State I served under. And she was preparing to go to North Korea. And so very soon after I was hired to be a Chinese intelligence analyst in the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, the focus really shifted to me working on China-North Korea rather than U.S.-China. And so I was working much more closely with Korean analysts, and I was providing the China perspective rather than the China-focused team that I was originally assigned to. And it was fascinating work because, of course, the foreign policy elements of how I had studied China earlier on came to play, as well as my Chinese language skills, so that I could add to some of the work that the State Department was doing together with the intelligence community, that community of different agencies helping the U.S. government think through how was the U.S. really going to start to negotiate with North Korea? What were the roles of other countries in helping the U.S. develop a policy towards North Korea?
It was great to hear the story. I think in North America, a lot of times we just think of, you know, America as the center of gravity, right? But sometimes people can forget that, oh, these other countries have relations too, right? It seems to me that's a bit of the perspective you were offering.
Yeah, I think that's right. And of course, the U.S. government has just such a great deep bench of expertise in different areas, and they call upon that with their foreign service officers, with their civil servants in different agencies to come together and really focus on an issue. And as a young new civil servant in the U.S. government, it was really exciting watching those teams get formed and playing a very, very small role in it. But it really did whet my appetite to do more. And so I entered the U.S. government as a presidential management fellow. We called them presidential management interns back in those days. But it was a 2-year program where you could work in different parts of the U.S. government. You could shift around as a civil servant and then stay in one agency at the end of the 2-year process. And so my home base was the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and I was working on this gig. But then I had an opportunity after the Secretary's visit to Pyongyang to then rotate. And I applied to go out to post. I really wanted to get back to China. I wanted to be improving my Chinese language skills. And I will never forget the day that I was sitting in my secure facility where I worked in the State Department, and the phone rang, and it was the Consul General in Shanghai, our U.S. Consul General, calling me. And the first question he asked me was, "Do you really speak Chinese?" And this was a language proficient consul general. He spoke very good Chinese. And that was the thing that really stood out to him in my application. And I had applied to all of the missions in China. You know, I didn't want to go back to Beijing. I wanted to be out of Beijing and in one of our consulates. And to him, somebody who spoke very good Chinese, it was important to bring on somebody who had Chinese language skills. And so I was hired to rotate out to our consulate in Shanghai as my next position at the State Department.
Did you have to speak with him in Chinese on that phone call?
You know, now that's a really good question. He didn't test me on the spot. But let me tell you what, as soon as I got out there, I was going to meetings with him that were taking place in Chinese. And so, you know, once you got out to post, I really had to prove my chops.
Well, maybe you could pull back the curtain a little bit for our listeners. And I'll preface this a little bit because our common friend, Robert Griffiths, he was the former consulate general in Shanghai, not the one that called you on the phone, right? It's later. In his experience, he speaks good Chinese.
Very good Chinese.
But he speaks in English, and you always have an interpreter for that official, and that official will speak in Chinese and interpret back in English to you. And so often the official meetings will happen in your own native language, right, with an interpreter to avoid miscommunication. But what was your experience like? And was this common? And how often were you able to actually use your Chinese in these types of meetings? Maybe you could just explain a few of the dynamics here.
Yeah, it's a great point. Absolutely, as Robert said, once you were doing official business, you wanted to use your native language. It was a way to ensure that your messages were being delivered wholly correctly. And for others who were in the room, maybe who didn't have the language skills, to be able to hear what you were saying was important too when you were conducting official business. But when you were having less official meetings, of course, it was a sign not just of respect, but of like American leadership that, you know, you had members of the embassy, or in this case, consulate team who spoke Chinese, who, you know, the U.S. government invested in training people to speak the language and go out and use it. It was very typical, you know, to have all the chit chat in Chinese before a meeting. But when you sat down to do the official meeting, and many times our Chinese counterparts spoke much better English than we spoke Chinese. I should make that point and underline it, that Chinese government officials oftentimes were beautiful English speakers. But when it came time to conduct official business, they too would want to speak in their native language to communicate effectively with, again, those within their own side of the table, their colleagues who didn't speak English. They wanted everyone in the room on the Chinese side to know exactly what they were saying. And we use the same practice in responding.
Well, maybe just for argument's sake, you say, well, maybe speaking Chinese wasn't that important. I know you said there's the chit-chat before and after the meeting and stuff, but I don't need to speak Chinese if I want to be in some sort of diplomatic, you know, conversation or position like this and conducting business. What would you say to that?
Well, if you flew in and flew out of China to conduct meetings, I would agree with that statement. You don't need to speak Chinese. However, if you are living in China and you're representing the U.S. government in China, I think, of course, you want to be learning more about where you are. You want to be actually building bridges between the U.S. and China, and language skills are a fundamentally important part of that. And the same consul general didn't want us out reporting all the time back to Washington about how China was changing. He wanted us building programs with Chinese counterparts. And that did require both language fluency as well as a cultural fluency, you know, an appreciation of what China needed to do at this time in the late 1990s. You may recall China was working to accede to the WTO. And so we were doing a lot of cooperative programs to help Chinese provincial and Shanghai municipal authorities get prepared for WTO accession.
Do you have any experience where maybe some of these meetings or something that being able to speak Chinese helped maybe avoid a misunderstanding or helped on some of the meetings or something you were actually trying to accomplish?
Yeah, well, that's been true in all of my jobs, where a role that I played when I was based in Shanghai for the State Department, and then later when I worked for the Commerce Department, you were hosting visitors from Washington, and they were having dialogue with Chinese counterparts, and they couldn't understand the Chinese. And so sometimes would rely on us to send a note saying that was mistranslated, or what they're really saying here is X, Y, or Z. And so there was always an appreciation for having Chinese speakers in the room in these negotiations so that the nuance of what was actually being said was communicated to the principal. You would never interrupt a meeting and say, oh, you translated that wrong. They were our interpreters, right? And so it was more about understanding really what was being said, sometimes understanding the communications happening on the other side of the room that were happening among participants. But again, the skill itself is really important, whether you're working officially for the U.S. government or in a commercial capacity or in a nonprofit capacity, just trying to communicate.
Well, it sounds like your whole Chinese skills and experience have taken you pretty far and been involved in some really interesting things. Maybe you could share perhaps some of the most interesting things that you've been able to be involved with and how Chinese played a part of that.
Having spent so many years working on China and working in China and with Chinese counterparts, that's offered me an incredible window into, one, how American stakeholders view China, but then how Chinese counterparts continue to look at their own role in the world. So for the past 14 years, I've been working at a company, Albright Stonebridge Group, co-leading the China practice together with a Chinese counterpart on the ground in China. The 30 of us who work in this small firm are helping American, European, Asian, foreign investors to navigate all of the changes happening in China. And it is a fascinating perch to me, as somebody who's fundamentally interested in continuing to watch China change and grow. And I had the real privilege of working with some real luminaries in American foreign policy, Sandy Berger, President Clinton's National Security Advisor, as well as Madeleine Albright, President Clinton's Secretary of State, are the founders of the firm where I work. And working with the two of them, going to China with quote-unquote old friends of China, that is how the Chinese view Sandy and Madeleine, was really fascinating. Because again, this whole concept of what does it mean to be a quote-unquote friend of China, Sandy and Secretary Albright both were fundamentally important in China and the U.S. coming to an agreement on China joining the World Trade Organization. That having been said, both Sandy and Secretary Albright were also, you know, part of the Clinton administration and then in unofficial capacities, many, many organizations that were highly critical of some Chinese behavior in China and on the global stage. And so watching the way that those dynamics played out when I was together with them in China was always really, really interesting to me. This is a credit to a lot of the Chinese counterparts we met, despite areas of real disagreement. I think there was a real interest and a hunger from a lot of Chinese counterparts to understand what was driving American foreign policy, whether a Democrat was a president or a Republican. You know, both Sandy Berger and Madeleine Albright had a lot of perspective, a lot of practical experience that Chinese counterparts always just wanted to tap into, trying to really figure it out themselves as they were talking to people like Sandy Berger and Madeleine Albright and many, many others.
Well, that's fascinating. That's fascinating. Well, Amy, you are a pretty busy individual. You have a lot of clients. You do a lot of things. What do you do to keep up your Chinese language skills these days?
Well, I fail at that, just to be perfectly honest, Jared, which is really unfortunate because it's sort of a cautionary tale more than anything else. If you don't use your Chinese, you really do lose it. But one thing that I've always enjoyed doing is reading Chinese newspapers. I don't tend to listen to a lot of Chinese media, but I do always like to read. It's harder and harder for me. And so tools that make it so easy now, I take advantage of. But I think one of the wonderful things we have here is a community of Chinese language speakers who try to keep opportunities open for Chinese language learners. And so those of you who have an opportunity to be in Washington or just to connect, the American Mandarin Society offers all kinds of great tools for Chinese language learners, programs in Washington, D.C., as well as language tools.
Well, that's great. Well, what kind of advice would you give to someone who's learning Chinese right now or even thinking about it? Because, you know, there's a lot of political sentiment right now about China. But what kind of advice would you give or perspective could you offer to someone who's learning the language right now and considering their options?
Well, I would say don't give up. I mean, China is going to continue to be so important in our world, and what better way to understand what that means for us than to continue to study Chinese? I think there will always be so many ways for you to use your Chinese language skills. And, you know, I've really loved working with different kinds of clients now that I've left the U.S. government and I'm in the private sector, having a whole new window into the whole range of options for those who are interested in a career where you can use your Chinese language skills. I'm working with many of those people, whether they're Chinese operating outside of China or, like you and myself, people who've studied Chinese in order to use it in professional capacities. You need to have an interest beyond Chinese language skills to, I think, guide you in what you want to do in your career. But it is only, you know, a great additive to what you can do if you have those language skills going into any kind of career search. And just, if I may, give a plug for the U.S. government service. I have worked outside of the U.S. government now longer than I worked in the U.S. government. But I have to say that was, I worked in four different federal government agencies. I worked in China and in Washington, D.C., different agencies of different sizes. I always loved being part of the meat grinder, being part of the interagency food fights on China policy. And in the 21st century, of course, there are going to be more and more of those opportunities, especially for Chinese language speakers, to be engaged in helping U.S. policymakers understand China, understand the perspective that China is putting out there for the world. And so there are just a whole range of opportunities for you to use those Chinese language skills in the service of the U.S. government. Really, some of the most exciting times in my career were in those negotiations with Chinese counterparts or in those windowless conference rooms talking about China policy and having a perspective with Chinese language skills to offer to policymakers on what we should be doing about China. Really, you can be, like I said, not in glorious, glamorous positions, but really playing a constructive role.
Well, I'm curious to know, because you know, we actually have a lot of podcast listeners from Europe and all around the world. And in your perspective and your experience on that, I'm sure you've met your quote-unquote counterparts, if you will, and probably other governments, right? Would you think that that perspective would also ring true for, you know, other governments or other places where someone learning Chinese would be living?
Absolutely. So in today's world, your experience working on China in Chinese will then help you as you're talking about other issues in a public service realm. In the private sector, the exact same thing is true. Your experiences working in China then translate to how you look at global supply chain issues or strategy issues, whether you're working on Latin America or you're working on the Middle East. That perspective that you gain from having studied Chinese and understanding elements of China in Chinese is highly applicable to other parts of your world. And so I guess I'm the rare person who decided in high school that I was going to have a career focused on China. And while that career has taken a lot of zigs and zags, it has remained focused on China. And I've watched others come in and out of the China world. But that Chinese language experience colors how they're working, even if it's not about China any longer. Gain a little bit of satisfaction from that even if many friends and former colleagues aren't still working on China, the experience of studying Chinese, of being in Nanjing or wherever it was, still shapes them as professionals. And so definitely not just an American thing.
You can leave China, but for some people, China never leaves you.
That to me is a very good thing.
Definitely. Well, Amy, this has been fascinating. I really appreciate you taking the time to share your experiences and your story with all of us and open up to my view, and I'm sure many people, the opportunities that learning Chinese can really create for you.
Well, such a pleasure and an honor to be with you too, Jared. I am a huge fan of the Seneca Network, and I'm a big supporter of the China Project. One of the ways that I stay current on what's happening in China is through their products and being a subscriber. So it's a pleasure and an honor to be with you today. Thank you.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, celebrity, builder, genealogist, planter, chemist, skier, barista, and that one gal named Susie. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at MannerCompanion.com or tag us on social media, hashtag MannerCompanion. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is Kaiser Kuo, and our interview editor is Dominic Edgley. And I'd like to thank our special guest, Amy Selico, and of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Past. See you next time.